Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Quick, if I asked you, what's a digital influencer? What would you think of?
Hi, everyone. It's Saturday. I'm in the suburbs, and here's what I'm wearing to go have lunch and run some errands with my dad.
Hi, guys. I'm going shopping today, and I wanted to show you my OOTD.
So this cardigan and matching tank top are from House of Sunny.
I got some bento boxes from Mitsuo. They look really good.
I just put on these jeans, and I cannot tell if the pocket fell off.
And then this purple cauliflower is the most stunning thing I've ever seen.
So I think that it becomes this idea of you are just taking pictures of your outfits and putting them on Instagram with a filter and making millions of dollars and, oh God, why don't people get real jobs?
Influencer Ayanna Lage there with a pretty accurate summation of the stereotype most people have of digital influencers. Primp, post, ka-ching. Well, Christina Najjar says it's anything but that.
I've made 3 TikToks a day, every day for over a year. I think I'm at like 400 days with no break now. And then on top of that, I do anywhere from like 5 to 10 minutes of Instagram content a day. And that is predominantly on my stories. So basically from the moment I wake up to the moment I go to sleep, I'm making content.
Najjar is better known online as Tinks. 365,000 Instagram followers, 1.4 million on TikTok. Tinks is an influencer, but she says her proper title ought to be content creator because, yes, there's the product pushing part of her influencer business, but she's best known for her comedy videos, like her Rich Mom series.
Rich Mom Starter Pack, Beverly Hills Edition. Here's what you'll need to fit in with the creme de la creme of Rich Moms. First, have Josh Flagg find you an enormous house, then decorate it. Oddly enough, a lot of people in Beverly Hills have absolutely no taste. So go crazy with the velvet. Go ham with the marble columns. No matter what the occasion, you're going to wear little leather leggings and a statement blazer. A Birkin is ideal.
You know, a video like a Rich Mom video, it's a full comedy skit. And the reason why they hit so hard is because they are researched. It's not just about where the rich moms get their hair done. It's which hairdresser. It's which exact Loro Piana sweater are they wearing. It's which SoulCycle instructor are they having an affair with. And it's those details that might seem throwaway that make them so Moorish and textured and rich. And you know, in my phone, I have literally hundreds and hundreds of notes in the notes app of just like skits that I want to do or ideas that I have. And then once I feel like they're ready, then I can create them. The actual filming doesn't take that long, but it's the research that really adds up.
Influencers are champions in the attention economy. The battle for that thumb-stopping content is won on creativity and trust. Tinks builds that trust with her followers through risky public vulnerability. For example, last spring, she revealed she had a new boyfriend and was falling in love, and then he cheated on her.
I fell really hard. I knew it. He knew it. You guys definitely knew it from all the boyfriend sickness callouts that I got. I allowed myself to fall really deep, and it felt amazing.
I just made this video because video creation, it's like, people think it's a job or it's always output, but it's also like the way that a lot of us process. And I do have that theme in my content of like vlogging and sharing my life with people. So I created because it was second nature for me to help me process in the moment. And then I did take pause and I thought, am I going to put this out? And the reason that I ultimately decided to do it is because my whole ethos is like, if I can save a girl out there time by telling her that I've been through something or giving her a tip, then that's like the purpose of my life.
But of course, and here, listener be warned, you're going to get a strong dose of my old lady cynicism. Because if purpose involves spending posting content almost every waking hour for 400 days straight, you got to get paid, right?
I always say, I am like a digital magazine So we take photos and we tell stories, except it's live. And so we're also live interacting with the people that are reading the magazine. And we have ads because, you know, the next question is always, you can make money doing that.
Julia Markham does, in fact, make a lot of money doing that, reportedly seven figures a year. She's the co-founder of Chris Loves Julia, an interior design blog and social media brand. 762,000 followers on Instagram alone. And Julia's been making enough money to hire seven employees.
I mean, I've spent the last 12 years building not only an audience, but a relationship with my audience. And that is not always there with a magazine, for instance. With influencer marketing and content creators, not only do you get to watch your favorite show whenever you open your phone, but they're also going to tell you about their favorite things.
Julia has worked with companies like Lowe's and eBay. Last spring, Tinks partnered with the fast casual restaurant Chipotle.
Guys, the Tinks is in the Chipotle app. This is the best day of my freaking life. And of course, Mini Mike made it in the picture.
In my opinion, the era of influencers just promoting anything for cash, that era is coming to a close. So Chipotle, I spoke a lot about it organically. I made videos about how much I love it. And the brand took notice of that. So that's the first point, right? Is the brand notices who's talking about this brand without being paid. Then we will put together, my team will put together a deal. So I think my Chipotle deal was a good 4 or 5 months or something. And within it, there's different aspects of that. You know, I was in a Chipotle commercial. My order was in the app. When I hit 200,000 followers, Chipotle actually gave out 2,000 meals to my followers for free.
Free for her followers, perhaps. But not for the content creators, because the work, time, and effort it takes to attract brands the way Tinks does, well, that comes at a different kind of cost.
I can see how people burn out, you know? People think that it's just this dream job where you just sit there and get free stuff and play on your phone. And it's complex and taxing and intense at times. That being said, you know, this is the first job that I've had that I care so much about. I'm literally obsessed with working. So right now I don't really take breaks, but there will be a time when I do.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're going to go even deeper inside influencer life and the burgeoning industry around digital content creators. And I'm joined today by Brooke Erin Duffy. She's an associate professor at Cornell University and co-author of Platforms and Cultural Production, also author of Not Getting Paid to Do What You Love, Gender, Social Media, and Aspirational Work. Professor Duffy, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Megan. It's great to be here today.
So you heard the voices and stories there of a couple really quite successful digital influencers, but help us take a step back here. I mean, how did we get here to a place where people can make, some people at least, can make very good livings off of the content that they create online, specifically through social media?
So how did we get here? Well, I think the first thing to understand, and I think this came across in the opening anecdotes, is that digital content creators or influencers provide us with advice or inspiration or entertainment. And in the process, they are recommending sponsored products or services. And there's this tendency to see this as a novel career. You know, we heard this from the accounts of Tinks and Julia about, I can't believe you get paid to do this. Mm-hmm. But this is not necessarily new. I often compare the work of creators or influencers to what media and cultural workers have long done, which is create and circulate content to audiences and in the process attract advertisers. And so just getting to your question of, again, how did we get here? I think with any new category of work, we can attribute this to just a rise or a confluence of social, economic, technological factors. So one of them, of course, is just the profound uptick in platforms and this idea that anyone can go on YouTube or TikTok and Instagram and seemingly, the narrative goes, mm-hmm. cultivate a following You know, we also have to understand the rise of creator culture against the backdrop of changes in the job economy. It is a lot harder to get a job in the traditional media and creative industries, whether we're talking about journalism or magazines or TV or movies. And finally, you know, and part of this, there's this sort of fetishization of independent careers. Mm-hmm. And by this, I mean the fact that, you know, I teach college students and I often ask them how many want to be entrepreneurs. And everybody wants to be an entrepreneur, but I think in a lot of ways, entrepreneurship is a euphemism for independent work where it's all on you. Success or failure is on your shoulders. Yeah. And so I think it's kind of this confluence of factors that has enabled the rise and rapid uptick of influencer culture.
You know, that's really interesting. And we're going to get in deeper into all of those. And especially we're going to hear from another content creator a little bit later, whose life and career so far really embodies everything that you just said, Professor Duffy. But I'm wondering, is it possible, I mean, given the sort of by definition, decentralized nature of technology and social media, is it possible for us to put any kind of shape around, like, how big is the influencer industry, or how much money are brands paying folks to, you know, to combine that trust they have with their followers with the product placement, if I could put it bluntly? Do we know?
I think it's hard to establish boundaries around this. I saw a New York Times report earlier this year that said the creator economy is the fastest growing small business. But one of the reasons it's so difficult to establish boundaries is, for one, a lot of people are doing this on the side, you know, the so-called side hustle. And so they may have a full-time or part-time job in a totally separate industry and are, you know, spending every free hour doing this. Another challenge is, as you said, the decentralized nature of this, which benefits platforms where there are very few systematic ways for the creators to come together and share what they're making. And that, yeah, of course, benefits platforms.
Well, we're going to talk about the platform and algorithmic side of this, too, a little bit later in the hour. But today we're going inside the influencer industry and the real life of what it's like to be a digital content creator. And hop on Facebook or Twitter. We're at On Point Radio. And let us know, are there particular influencers that you really trust? And if they say, hey, I also happen to like this product, would you buy it? We'll have more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're going inside the digital influencer industry. And I'm joined by Brooke Erin Duffy. She's a professor at Cornell University and co-author of the new book, Platforms and Cultural Production. And joining us now is Ayanna Lage. She's with us from Tampa, Florida. She's a freelance writer and lifestyle blogger and a digital content creator. Ayanna, welcome to On Point.
Hi, it's so good to be here.
So tell us a little bit about the kind of content you create online. What do you do?
Yeah, so I mostly share everyday life. It's a lot of motherhood, pictures of my family, while also getting real about topics important to me, like social justice and mental health awareness. But it's a little bit of everything.
Okay, so important topics, frank talk about your life as well, and then we'll talk about sort of the business side in a second here. But what did you do before becoming a full-time sort of independent influencer online?
Yeah. So I feel like, long story short, I went to college for print journalism, and then out of college pivoted to working in marketing and digital public relations. And then almost 3 years ago, stepped away from a role as a content marketing manager to work for myself, which was very scary, but I'm glad I did it.
And can you tell us a little bit about why you decided to make that turn?
Yeah, I think that I had a moment. I was blogging on the side and also doing some freelance marketing and writing work. And I had this inkling that I would be able to match or even go over my corporate salary if I like took a leap of faith and spent all of my time on the creative things that I was doing. So yeah, that was my motivation.
And did you achieve that?
Yes. Not immediately. Don't get me wrong. Not like the first day. But yeah, at this point, I did.
Okay. And so what did that take, though? Because, I mean, so hearing you, we tend to, frame these conversations in terms of the extreme successes or the extreme failures. But the truth is always, for most people, somewhere in between. So what did it take for you to get to the point where you're making now more than you were previously in your corporate work?
Yeah. So I think that it took a few things. I think the most relevant is probably that I had to start charging more. I think that it's a lot easier to negotiate a salary with a boss, at least in my experience, than to, as a independent business or contractor, try to convince people to pay you more. So that was a huge part. And then also, especially like with the influencer side of it, to be a little bit more selective with the brands that I worked with. So to do fewer brand deals, but for more money.
Mm. And so to be clear, when you say working with brands, how does that show up in the actual content that you're creating?
Yeah. So it's typically, for me at least, I would say it falls into a few buckets. Sharing on my blog, like a written blog post that's sponsored by a brand. Sharing content on Instagram that is, again, sponsored by a brand. Or taking pictures or videos and allowing a brand to use them in their marketing and advertising without my followers ever seeing any of that on my channels.
Okay, that's interesting. So, Professor Duffy, what do you hear in Ayana's story and career so far?
So I think it's really important that she acknowledged that this is not immediate. There's this very pervasive narrative of overnight success, right? You put up this content on TikTok or Instagram, it goes viral, and next thing you know, brands en masse are reaching out to you. And that is the exception rather than the rule. I've been studying this community for quite some time, and I found that, you know, those who do achieve success, and I see this very much as kind of a winner-take-all system, have some kind of access to the creative industries. And so, here we have this case of Ayana working in having a background in print journalism, and also, again, the deferred payoff. I mean, how she worked for quite some time before she saw, the kind of level of success, and thinking about the kind of social safety net that people need to take the risk to go out on their own and leave a full-time career in order to pursue this line of work, I think is really important.
Yeah. So Ayana, do you want to talk about that a little bit? Because you did take on, by leaving the sort of structure of a corporate job and the employment benefits that usually come along with that, you did take on like sort of all that risk onto yourself. What was that like?
Yeah. You know, I'm so glad that we're talking about this, because I try to be very open about the fact that had I not had a husband with a job that provided health insurance for both him and I, that I would have had to wait much longer to leave my job. I would not have been able to afford to pay for independent health insurance at the point when I left. So I think that there are little things like that that did make it just practically made it easier for me to walk away when I did. And then also having, double income and being able to save some money ahead of time. Had I been single or living alone, I think it would have been more difficult. I definitely think that whenever you walk away from a job, it's a risk, but in some cases riskier than others. And I kind of dislike this very pervasive notion that everyone needs to quit their 9-to-5 and, you know, hustle and become an entrepreneur, because I think that the grass is always greener.
Well, I mean, look, from what you're describing and from what we heard Julia Markham and Tinks talk about earlier in the beginning of the show, it sounds like all consuming work, to be honest, because that machine of follower demand is like totally insatiable. I mean, do you ever feel like it's kind of taken over your life, Ayana?
Oh, yeah. All the time. I think that it can be hard. I mean, there really is no boundary between life and work because my job is sharing my life. So it's very difficult to figure out where to draw the line and log off and, you know, even which moments shouldn't be shared.
So, Professor Duffy, this is making me think, I ought to ask you, in any sort of emerging industry, how do we define in this case sort of who are the groups that hold the power here, right? Because the ostensibly the content creators, the influencers themselves can choose what they want to do, who they want to partner with, et cetera. The brands will hold power by virtue of their, you know, their size and their money. The platforms do as well. And then there's the demands of the followers themselves. I mean, who's the dominant player in this dance here?
I think you really hit the nail on the head, Megan, in terms of these various groups. And I think it's easy to suggest that, oh, creators have all the power because they can, post whatever they want and work with whoever they want. And that is certainly not the reality. Brands play an incredibly powerful role in making decisions about who to work with, what their contracts entail, how much they are paid, or in a lot of cases not paid. You know, there's this often deferred promise of exposure. And so brands will send aspiring influencers so-called swag without any kind of material compensation. But absolutely, the platforms benefit tremendously from the creator economy and in a lot of ways hide in the shadows of this system where the attention tends to be on audiences, creators, and brands. And so thinking about how platforms are reaping tremendous rewards from the attention and audiences that creators bring to their platforms, but there's a lot of really problematic ways they treat creators, including the fact that they leave them out of a lot of decisions, including about the daily operations. And I know you said we can talk about algorithms later. Mm-hmm. I think that's a really important point of how creators have to struggle with platforms' invisible algorithmic systems.
Okay, so we will do that. But the sort of the lack of transparency or sort of the built-in opacity in this new industry is really, really interesting. So I want to hear a little bit more about that, because we did speak with another influencer, and she talked to us about how it's really often not clear how much people are making.
How much I make as a part-time content creator. I've talked a lot on this account about how much I make at my full-time job, because big ol' salary scales and bonuses are all public. But content creation, brand partnerships, way less transparent. Which is why I think we should talk about it, because information is power. And I have to admit that
that's Cece Shia in a video she posted to TikTok last week. Shia has 382,000 TikTok followers. She also works full-time as an associate at a law firm. In the spring of 2020, she started making TikTok videos about her life, her career, how to make it in the legal profession. Her most popular video has 8 million views.
Another day in my life as a New York City attorney. I wake up and immediately make my bed because I'm type A like that. I start my workday by taking notes during a client call to get background on the client's data flows, unmuting myself only to say 10 words.
I did not expect it to be that popular, but it turns out people just had a thirst for what adult life is like. And I think especially because TikTok tends to be a younger generation,
And I think about it. And when I was in middle school, high school, I didn't know what being an adult was like. I didn't know what having any job was like. So I think people like to see others and get a glimpse into their life, and especially adult life, which I don't think, aside from your parents, you don't really see into.
Adulting. Sorry, couldn't help it. A few months ago, Cece decided to take on some brand partnerships.
I've done 3 brand partnerships in the past 2 months, and I have made $24,500 from those 3 brand partnerships.
For each brand partnership, she created 1 to 2 videos and a set of Instagram stories. And she says the money is worth the effort, but there's also a lack of information, as we said, to help influencers negotiate with those brands.
I think especially with younger creators / people less experienced with negotiations and business, they are more likely to agree to things because they don't know what their worth is. They don't know how to negotiate. And that's, I think, one of the unfortunate aspects of creating content, is that the sophistication of the field as a whole is very, very low. In even thinking about what my rates should be in the beginning, I went to, I think, at least 10 different rate calculators, and they all gave me wildly different results.
Now, Julia Markham, whom you heard from at the beginning of the show, the content creator who is making more than 7 figures a year and enough to hire 7 employees, she's also trying to use her power and experience to close that information gap. She founded an organization called Good Influencer that coaches content creators on navigating the business side of their work. And the biggest issue Julia hears, that companies want to pay creators with products, not money.
The biggest issue that we see across the board, doesn't matter how many followers they have, is brands are offering these influencers product in exchange for exposure. That's not okay, because even if it's a washer and dryer, is not going to pay your bills. And so we get a lot of that. And we always say, if you want to do 1 free campaign, to, you know, product only campaign to get your feet wet, do it. And then after that, we got to start charging.
Cece Shia agrees.
I dance. And I think one of the beauty of dance is that you make it seem effortless, even though behind the scenes, there's endless hours put into making it look effortless. And I see that similarity in content creation as well. There's a lot of hours put in, but the product should always appear effortless. And I think that effortless appearance at the end is what creates this illusion that creators don't work a lot, that they just stand in front of a camera and do something and get paid. And that's not really the reality of the situation.
Influencers Cece Shia and Julia Markham. Ayanna Lage, let me turn back to you here, because how did you navigate this about trying to figure out the best way to negotiate with some very powerful brands? Where did you land?
Honestly, in the beginning, I just guessed. I would just throw numbers out. Julia mentioned, there is a lot of pressure to be really happy when a brand wants to give you free product. And it took me probably a couple of years to realize that they weren't offering out of the goodness of their hearts. It wasn't like this charitable act. They realized that, you know, the cost of shipping a free product is basically nothing to them. And then requiring me to send them a ton of pictures and videos, like it's a pretty sweet deal for a brand. But yeah, in the beginning, I asked for like $50 to $100, I think, for like, once I realized that brands were interested in paying me, just because I was afraid to ask for anything else.
And was there sort of another layer of complication as a person of color? Because I wonder how that factors into, again, navigating any new and emerging industry.
Yeah, that is such a relevant question, because I think that for me, everything changed last summer after the murder of George Floyd, when there was all of this social pressure on brands to do a better job with paying Black creators and just diversifying their approach to marketing. I went from struggling. I mean, granted, because of COVID, a lot of brands were tightening their budgets. So I hadn't had a brand deal in a while. I went from struggling to getting so many offers that I had to get an influencer management agency to handle my partnerships for me. So that was a very, very interesting experience for me because my content hadn't really changed that much. I had the same approach to social media, but it wasn't until then that I found brands who were willing to pay me fairly.
So you have a management agency now. Did you have to sort of rise to a certain level before the management agency would take you on?
I have around like 48,000 Instagram followers. So definitely not a mega influencer by any stretch of the imagination. So I didn't realize that you could get management with a smaller following, but it's been helpful.
Okay. So Professor Duffel, you've got about a minute before the next break here, but this sounds like a lot. I mean, this is just yet another version of the challenges that workers in the gig economy face, for example. There's no organization around it. And as you said, because of, I like that phrase, the fetishization of entrepreneurship, the idea is that individuals should know how to navigate through a system like this.
Yeah. So as we've heard, there is a lot of atomization in the industry. You know, brands are disincentivized to publicly state how much they are paying people, is that would just amp up the competition. And Ayana just mentioned her partnership with a management agency. But for most of the aspiring workers trying to navigate this, they lack the agency and structures of support that can help them earn their worth.
Okay, so we're going to talk about more of the challenges of trying to get into and survive the new industry of digital content creation when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're going inside the digital content creator industry, the influencer industry. And I'm joined today by Ayana Lage. She's a freelance writer and lifestyle blogger and a digital content creator. And Brooke Erin Duffy joins us as well, associate professor at Cornell University and co-author of Platforms and Cultural Production. And Professor Duffy, earlier you had said, I think quite accurately, that in a sense, this kind of work has been around kind of forever, right? It's not unfamiliar, the commodification of creativity and then the interest that might draw from businesses and brands. But one thing that previous generations of sort of hardworking creative freelancers haven't had to face is an unknowable, invisible algorithm that totally controls who sees what work. So let's talk about that a little bit. I mean, for example, I think it was a couple of years ago, Instagram went from being something that that automatically just in your feed you saw a chronological post, and it went from that to something else. So what impact does something like that have on influencers?
You're absolutely right, Meghna, in that creative workers from book authors to musicians to TV writers, they've always faced a level of unpredictability. You know, who knows what's going to, quote unquote, do well with audiences, what's going to resonate, what's going to draw box office sales, or what's going to make the bestseller chart. So there's a level of unpredictability there. But in the platform ecosystem, this unpredictability is amplified by the fact that we don't know, and we're not supposed to know, how algorithms work. And you mentioned the case of Instagram's algorithm. And if anyone is a user of Instagram, and I imagine many of the listeners are, I mean, it was frustrating, right? All of a sudden, content was appearing out of chronological order, and we weren't sure why we were seeing posts a week ago. But, you know, it didn't fundamentally impact our lives. If you're a content creator, your career is wrought by the visibility or lack of invisibility of this invisible algorithm. And so I have talked to many creators who say, in addition to the grueling demands of this profession, they now have to think about how to respond to the algorithm, how to game the algorithm, how to reverse engineer this unknowable feature so that their content can still be seen to audiences.
Yeah, can I just jump in here? Because we got a really interesting comment on Twitter from a listener who wants us to talk about the dark side of this, because the listener says, I know several young people who are constantly putting themselves at risk because of the algorithm, or trying to figure it out, as you said.
Not just trying to figure it out, but research I did this summer, we were talking to marginalized content creators on TikTok and Instagram. And a lot of them mentioned that their content would appear on what they said was the wrong side of the algorithm. And so if we were talking about members of the LGBT community, all of a sudden their posts were showing up on the feeds of ultra conservative factions. And so they were getting a lot of hate and harassment. And so not only can the algorithm be a launching pad or detrimental to your career, but it can actually make you visible to people who are going to hate, critique, troll you.
Uh-huh. So the trolling part, trolling doesn't even seem to be a strong enough word anymore, but we'll come back to that in a second, because I also just want to emphasize, I think the listener was talking about how sometimes influencers feel like they have to go to even more extremes in the content that they're posting for it to be seen. But I'm going to play the foil here a little bit. And Ayan, I'll turn to you for this. TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, what have you, they're not in the business of helping content creators be seen, right? They're in the business of keeping eyeballs on their sites. Right, so, yeah. You know, like when they tweak their algorithm, which is their property, what's your response to? They don't actually have any obligation to tell you, well, now here's how it'll be easier for you to get seen.
Yeah. You know, I do think that the prevailing idea among the creators that I am friends with is that we do provide a service for them in the sense that we are prioritizing their platforms when sharing content. And often cases, because the algorithm is unpredictable, paying to boost posts on these platforms. So it can get frustrating. I definitely don't feel entitled to Instagram or TikTok or Facebook helping me be successful, just because that's not what they're focused on. It definitely is tricky that you could, you know, post the same thing one day and then get a great response. And then the next day, you know, for whatever reason, you might get half the response. It's a guessing game on when to share what you're sharing.
Mm. So Professor Duffy, then where would you, what's your conclusion here about the algorithmic influence in the influencer industry? I mean, what conclusions do you draw?
I think it introduces a new level of precarity to these careers, or a new level of instability. And so going back to what we talked about earlier, you know, of course, there's always been this level of capriciousness in creative careers. But now creators are not just thinking about, what they want to create and put out there into the world, or what audiences are going to demand, but how to play to the algorithm for a platform that may not even be there in a few weeks. I mean, I think that's, another level of instability that creators have to reckon with. You know, right now we're talking about Instagram and TikTok, but who knows if we'll be talking about the same platform a couple months or years from now.
Yeah. You know, it is a strange thing to try and wrap your head around, because yesterday I was thinking, well, what would be sort of the analogy in my world of work? And I came up with this, and tell me if you think this is fair, both of you. Like, I know what the rules are for what I can't say on the radio, on a broadcast. I mean, the FCC is pretty clear about that. My home station here, WBUR, has rules. So there's transparency about that. But in your world, I mean, if we had those same rule, functioning here, an algorithmic functioning here, like, I could come on the air and say something that seemed completely acceptable and then, like, just get fired but not know why, because they just changed the rules the day before. I mean, is that kind of how it feels sometimes, Ayanna?
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely think so. I mean, maybe like the more apt comparison would be like no one listens.
That's true. Yeah. Total nightmare. But yes, I hear you. I hear what you're saying.
Yeah, no, I mean, it definitely, it's not like other industries I've been in where even if it's evolving and it's exciting there, you still feel like you know what's going on. It can definitely get a little bit hectic.
Okay. Now, Professor Duffy, then what ought to be done about this? Because, again, I just think, is this just kind of a reality about the modern day economy that people have to accept that the market, the literal market in which they're working in, that space is controlled by a small handful of really huge Silicon Valley businesses?
So one way to think about this is, not just the impact on individual creators, but what is the sort of structural situation of this? And, recent years have brought to attention how very lopsided the creator economy is in terms of, TikTok came under fire for concealing creators of color in gaming communities. Women tend to be marginalized. And so I think platforms need to be held more accountable. Another place this plays out where is protecting the creators from exposure to hate and harassment. I mean, again, I don't think that platforms are doing enough to protect creators when really they're their lifeblood. The creators are bringing so much attention and hence data and hence advertisers and hence money to these sites. But a lot of times the way they treat creators is kind of mere lip service.
Well, before today's program, we actually, Ayanna, we talked to you about your experience receiving end of hate and harassment. And you told us that you've dealt with it a lot. For example, especially after you made a video in response to a QAnon conspiracy theory. Let's listen to that video.
So over the weekend, a conspiracy theory went super viral that originated from QAnon / far right corners of the internet about Wayfair shipping children in industrial cabinets. I just have been extremely troubled because I've seen a lot of people saying, if you posted about Black Lives Matter and you don't post about this, then one of the actual things I saw in an influencer's story was, then you are disgusting.
So that's the video, Ayanna, that you posted. What happened after that?
As you can imagine, if you know anything about QAnon, the response wasn't, I had a feeling that people would feel very strongly. And I mean, variations of, you don't care about children, you don't care about child abuse, how dare you call this fake? And then, of course, people, saying, because the whole point of the video was really like, this has nothing to do with the Black Lives Matter movement, Black Lives Matter is trafficking children. I mean, it just went on and on and on with people who didn't follow me. These were all complete strangers.
And how did you handle that?
I handled it, but I mean, I feel like that's the really only tool that a lot of these platforms give us, which is blocking people. So that was like my most efficient way of approaching it, just because I will sometimes go for like reasonable dialogue if I feel like someone is genuinely curious. But I'm like, if this is someone who's never interacted with me and this is all that they've come here to say, it's probably not going to be fruitful for me to engage.
Professor Duffy, talk more about this because, this is something that people on the who dwell in social media spaces are going to have to deal with on a day-to-day basis. But to it seems like for influencers, because they're out there so fully with their entire lives, they, as you've mentioned several times, they are particular targets for even organized campaigns of hate and harassment, right?
Absolutely. And it very much, a lot of this can be understood within that framework of creators and influencers, quote unquote, put themselves out there. That's part of the job. But this command to be out there, to be visible, often hinges on vulnerability, especially for women, for people of color, for the LGBTQ community, and so on. And so I think the exposure to hate and harassment they get is part of the job that is not widely understood. And it's not just these targeted critiques on their own accounts. There are dedicated sites to policing the activity of influencers. The one that I have studied is called Get Off My Internets. And it's essentially a sprawling community of individuals who scrutinize the posts of top influencers, the majority of whom are women. And so you see everything from critiques of their appearance to calling out their parenting to calling them product shills and much worse names. And again, it's these very coordinated systems that are scrutinizing and, you know, quote unquote, hating on people's every moves. And so there is a very profound downside of this job that is all wrapped up in this ideal of putting yourself out there.
Oh my God, people, get a life. Really, if you're just, right? I mean, if you're going to dedicate yourself to doing nothing but take down and critique folks who are actually trying to make a living in this digital world that we're all inhabiting, please get a life. Okay. Anyway, that's not really a public radio moment, is it? But I'm going to put it out there anyway. Look, we have a comment on Twitter of someone who says, creatives, stop giving your work away for free to the social media platforms. Ayana, I wonder what you think about that.
That's a very interesting point that I think I have considered. But to just put it succinctly, I just feel like if brands are paying me to post on social media, that is more lucrative for me than if I'm sharing content, you know, in a newsletter or even on my own website or podcast. So it's kind of hard to step away. But yeah, I mean, I'd also make the argument that I, even before starting to blog, shared my entire life on these platforms. So it's like, at least now I'm making something for it.
Okay. So that brings us back to, you know, when we say the word industry, underlying all that is the fact that people are trying to make a living. Brands and companies are trying to sell products. I mean, there's money involved. So, Professor Duffy, in the last 30 seconds that we have, what's a recommendation you'd make regarding, again, the economy part of all this? We talked about transparency earlier.
I think, of course, transparency and the sort of crowdsource campaigns we've seen spring up in recent years. FU Pay Me is one of these that is kind of crowdsourced data. People are getting paid will contribute to transparency and education in this industry and challenge the fact that creators are often siloed from one another.
Mm. Well, Brooke Erin Duffy, associate professor at Cornell University and co-author of Platforms and Cultural Production, also author of Not Getting Paid to Do What You Love, Gender, Social Media, and Aspirational Work. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was really great to chat, Magda.
And Ayana Lage, freelance writer and lifestyle blogger. Ayana, it was great to have you. Thank you so much for helping us go inside the industry and life of digital influencers.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
I'm Magda Chakrabarty. This is On Point.